It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. Some anxiety is normal, but anxiety that interferes with your ability to live a normal life, anxiety that overwhelms, paralyzes, or even terrifies you, that may be an anxiety disorder. And this hour, we're going to talk about living with and treating anxiety disorders. My first guest is Kelly Garrett of Iowa City. She's been living with an anxiety disorder for 6 years, and she can pinpoint the exact moment that things got really difficult. Hello, Kelly.
Good morning, Charity. Thank you for having me.
Well, thank you so much for being here. And let's go back to 2011. And you lived through a traumatic event that really started off this chain of events with anxiety. Tell me what happened.
Sure. So I've always been a worrier and that kind of thing, but it never really interfered with my life in a way that was meaningful. And in December of 2011, I was working at a local bank, and we were held up at gunpoint towards the end of the day. And it was a very traumatic experience. And at the time, I got through everything, and we did what we needed to do and everything. But that night, I had what I would call my first real panic attack, the first one that came truly out of nowhere that really blindsided me and was really incapacitating. And since then, it's gotten, I wouldn't say worse, but it's stayed at about the same level, truthfully. And it has been, like you said, about 6 years now. And so since that time, I have, started seeing some doctors and been on some medication and that kind of thing. But it really does, in spite of all of those things, it really does interfere with my life in a really large way.
Describe what a panic attack feels like. What happens?
It's terrifying. The walls close in. My heart starts beating really fast. My hands get all sweaty. I can't breathe. The room starts spinning. Sometimes I see what I would call floaters in my eyes. Like, my things start looking almost glittery, like sparkly. I start hyperventilating. I don't have any logical or rational thoughts. It just seems like everything is piling down on top of me, and the whole world is crumbling. And even logical explanations about, well, that's not really going to happen, or that's not a rational thought to have, that's not something that's going to happen, doesn't help really to any meaningful degree.
How long does it last?
It depends on the attack and what brings it on. When I'm medicated and am in a better place, they can last from 10 to 20 minutes, which I would call a shorter one, honestly. And when I'm unmedicated, I think the longest one I've ever had lasted for 4 straight days.
Oh, wow. And that first one, I can just imagine, having never had that happen to you before, what was going through your mind? I mean, did you think you were having a heart attack?
I think I did know it was a panic attack. I grew up with several people who also dealt with mental illness and anxiety and depression. And so it wasn't an entirely foreign experience to me. It was internally, but from as a bystander, I've witnessed similar things before. So I did sort of know what was happening and logically knew there was an end to it and I was probably going to be okay and all of that. But in the moment, it feels like the world is ending.
These panic attacks, I mean, you said they come out of nowhere. Do they seem to be triggered by something?
They can be. It really depends. When there's something really stressful happening, I'm more susceptible to them. So, a new job, or when my car died a couple weeks ago, when the babysitter unexpectedly cancels, that certainly makes me more susceptible to them when I'm already stressed out. And then smaller things can really set them off. But they also come from larger things that you would think that they would stem from, frustrations with insurance companies. Not getting the job I thought I was going to get, or something to that effect. Sometimes I can feel them coming. Sometimes I can feel them building up inside of me. And sometimes they really do come truly out of the blue.
I can imagine that would be incredibly dangerous if you were, let's say, in a vehicle driving or something like that. Has that happened to you?
Yeah, absolutely. I've had to pull over before, sobbing too hard that I can't see the road, or not being able to breathe. Luckily, it doesn't happen while I'm driving too much, but it certainly has happened in the past.
So back in 2011, when this started happening to you, after you went through the robbery and you had that first panic attack, you sought help. And as you mentioned, you had dealt with depression in the past. So you had been to care providers in the past, but you went to the doctor. What were they able to do for you?
So the first doctor I went to was really focused on post-traumatic stress disorder and trauma. She was referred to me after the robbery. And so I started seeing her for really that specific trauma event. And we started with, you know, some anxiety medication, some talk therapy, some sort of standard things. And as we dove deeper into my past and my brain and some other troubles that I've had, we realized that there was probably more at play than just anxiety, and that the robbery really triggered a lot of it, but it wasn't the true cause, that there was really some underlying issues. And so we started digging into more of that. And then I switched to a more generic sort of, I don't want to say specialist, doctor, a few years after that, and have been switching between doctors since then to try to find someone who's helpful.
So saying that you've been trying to find someone who's helpful, that indicates to me that you haven't found a lot of relief.
I haven't found a lot of relief. I've been on as many anxiety medications as I can count, and it seems that a lot of them will work for a month or two, but not in the long term. They'll you know, slow things down for a while, but then it seems like the effectiveness wears off. Alternatively, there's medications that you can take as a sort of one and done. You know, you're in a panic attack, this is to help me calm down kind of medication, as opposed to daily regimen. And I found that to be more helpful, but it really only helps the moment. It's not helping the underlying causes or the long term problem. It's just helping that very short term problem that you're in. But I have seen several doctors and have switched sort of back and forth between people. I have struggled to find someone who I feel like is giving me both medication that's helpful and is also able to really support the type of talk therapy that I think I need. So yeah, I've struggled.
In addition to struggling to find the right treatment, you also have challenges with getting your healthcare to pay or your insurance to pay for treatment.
That's true.
Tell me about that.
Absolutely. So I have what I consider to be pretty great insurance. I have a pretty low deductible. It covers, you know, everything I could think of. And there's one particular medication that I have found helpful in the past, but it doesn't come in a generic. It's only a brand name medication. And last summer, I was able to be on it via free samples, and then the rep stopped coming. And so the free samples wore off. And a few weeks ago, I was prescribed medication again to try it. You know, it's been a couple of months. I have a different insurance than I had last time, so we thought we'd try it again. And it came back from the pharmacy after my insurance paid $750. The charge was still $1,700 for about 30 pills.
Wow. Like a month's worth
Worth, yeah. Yeah.
So that's just not something
that's absolutely not sustainable by any means.
So you had to walk out of the pharmacy.
I did.
Without the medication that you had waited so long to get.
I did. I waited 6 months to see the doctor that prescribed it. I was on a wait list for 6 months to get in, and he prescribed me this medication on my very first appointment, and I had to leave it at the pharmacy because I couldn't afford it.
Wow. How did that feel?
Heartbreaking. It's one of the only things I've ever been on that has helped for more than a couple of weeks, has really felt like it made a difference to the underlying problems, as opposed to just really treating the symptoms, and to not be able to get it, and then to really have both my insurance company and the prescription company sort of tell me that I was out of luck is really frustrating.
Anxiety, and we'll talk about this much more this hour, but anxiety disorders are something that a lot of people think that they know a lot about, because we all experience anxiety. And I know from people who have dealt with anxiety disorders that there's a lot of well-meaning advice given from friends. Oh, try yoga, try meditation, try this. This will work for you. Do you get a lot of that?
I do. And you know, I appreciate it. Everybody's trying to help. And I'm sure that sometime I will hear something I've never heard before, but you know, I've tried yoga, I've tried meditation. Meditation just gives me 25 minutes to ruminate on all of my problems. So, you know, it's not,
I've tried other options. It's not that I am trying to, you know, rely on medication or anything like that. Not that that's a bad thing. But, you know, I have tried other things. And what works for me is medication. And so to not be able to have that really feels like I'm – like other people don't want me to be well.
What would you want people to understand about an anxiety disorders? If people – if everybody could know one thing about this.
Oh, my. That's a difficult question. I wasn't prepared for that one. I would say that the biggest thing to remember is just that there isn't really much that someone who's experiencing a lot of anxiety needs you to help them with, probably, aside from just being present. I have found that when I'm in a panic attack, you know, nobody telling me that everything's going to get better or it's going to pass, that kind of thing doesn't really help. What I really need is just someone who understands that what I'm going through is not my fault to just sort of talk to me and just say that you know, it's not my fault. Everything's going to be okay. I'm here for you. I will help what I can, as opposed to trying to offer some of those more tangible help things.
When you look at the future right now, how do you feel?
Scared, anxious. Honestly, you know, I look at the healthcare that's currently sitting in the Senate and what I was doing to healthcare, and I'm worried. I mean, I feel like I have really good insurance, and if I'm in this boat, what is somebody who doesn't have good insurance in? I mean, I know I'm not alone in my anxiety, and I know that even though I have serious anxiety, that there are people who have it worse than me or just as bad, and you know, they don't have the same resources that I do, and so what are they supposed to do?
Well, Kelly, I hope you get the help you need, but thank you so much for sharing your story with
us
today.
Thank you so much for having me, Charity.
Kelly Garrett of Iowa City. She lives with an anxiety disorder, and this hour we'll continue to talk about living with an anxiety disorder, treating an anxiety disorder. Coming up in just a moment, I'll talk with psychologist Karen Nelson of the University of Iowa College of Medicine and Dr. Adnan Iqbal. He's medical director of adult psychiatric services at Mercy Medical Center in Des Moines. A little later on, we'll hear from a 17-year-old who is living with an anxiety disorder, and you are welcome to join the conversation as well. 866-780-9100 is the number to call or send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. This is Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. This hour, we're talking about living with an anxiety disorder. This is a common problem that a lot of people, maybe as much as 12% of the population, deals with on a regular basis. And with me now is Karen Nelson. She is a licensed psychologist and associate clinical professor of psychiatry in the College of Medicine at the University of Iowa. Hello, Karen.
Hello there.
Thank you so much for being here.
My pleasure.
And I also want to bring Dr. Adnan Iqbal into the conversation. He is medical director of adult psychiatric services at Mercy Medical Center in Des Moines. Hello, Dr. Iqbal.
Hello. How are you?
Very good. Thank you so much for being here. And I know that both of you work with people who deal with anxiety disorders. Dr. Iqbal, let me ask you first, when somebody comes to you who is exhibiting symptoms of having an anxiety disorder, where do you begin?
Basically, anxiety disorder, it's a big umbrella kind of diagnosis. Anxiety disorder, you know, contains several other conditions, not only panic attack. I mean, it seems like we discussed at length panic attacks with Kelly.
Mm-hmm.
In addition to panic attack, there are various other conditions. Some of them are called social, you know, generalized anxiety disorder, separation anxiety disorder, and, you know, phobias, post-traumatic stress disorder. So this whole big umbrella of anxiety disorder, you know, basically covers lots of other, you know, diagnoses. So first and foremost, you know, we'll go through the history, presentations. Obviously, it's called psychiatric admission assessment. And the important aspect, we also inquire about whether there are certain medical conditions which can also lead to these, psychiatric anxiety symptoms. This could be, you know, thyroid conditions or, you know, you name it. And plus, you know, there are certain medications or drug use. So there are lots of etiology which can lead to anxiety disorder. it can start without any precipitating event, like, Kelly has a trauma which almost kind of jump-started her symptoms. So you go through all these potential possibilities, then you rule out any medical conditions, and, eventually come up with a diagnosis, which is called, working diagnosis or differential diagnosis, and then you decide the treatment.
Well, and we'll talk about some of the different directions you can go with treatment. Karen, when Kelly was talking about that event that kind of triggered this for her, how common is that where somebody has a triggering event that might cause their anxiety to become something that's difficult to live with?
It is fairly common. And what Kelly, I think, would be the first to say is that she'd hoped that it would... that she would be able to move past it more effectively. And I certainly agree with what Dr. Iqbal has said. I would say that the research shows that the right kind of psychotherapy, typically cognitive behavioral therapy, has a really strong track record with being helpful with all of the different forms under the anxiety umbrella.
Well, and we were talking earlier again about medication and how that can help some people with an anxiety disorder. As you are moving forward with a diagnosis, I mean, it sounds like treatment can go in so many different directions. So, Karen, how do you decide what direction to go?
Just as Dr. Iqbal indicated, mental health professionals, I'm a psychologist, would rely on a carefully listening to the symptoms. So the treatment for a simple phobia using cognitive behavioral therapy would be a bit different than a treatment for panic. Likewise, might be a little bit different than the treatment for social anxiety or obsessive compulsive disorder. A common thread would be looking at the link between thoughts or beliefs and actions.
Give me an example of that.
When we're anxious, we feel globally incompetent. And so, Kelly was describing needing to pull off the road, even though she's a good driver, when anxiety became so distressing. So being able to look at what her interpretation of those physical symptoms that come on board accompanying a panic attack, and she's obviously very smart, use her good brain to be able to, not in the heat of the moment, but to be able to identify alternatives and alternative possibilities so that she can kind of navigate those physical symptoms, recognize that as much as they feel catastrophic, that in fact she's always gotten through them in the past, either with or without medication, but that she will survive it. And so kind of turning off some of the body alarms is one of the first keys. And that's a large part of what medication can be useful for.
Dr. Iqbal, do you have anything you want to add to that?
Yes, I think she's right about these triggers. And I think anxiety, I mean, people who do not suffer with anxiety, when they face with a sort of anxiety-provoking situation like performance or going to a social event, and we ourselves have experienced how incapacitating can be at certain times. And when you imagine when someone with panic attack anxiety, their anxiety is so profound, so overwhelming, it's almost incapacitating. So at that moment, when you're totally overwhelmed with this anxiety, medications do tend to bring down this overwhelming feeling of anxiety, incapacitation. So symptom intensities goes down. At that moment, that's when the psychotherapy, cognitive behavior therapy, comes into play. That's when patient has enough mental strength to participate in cognitive behavior therapy or anxiety-focused therapy. And then they can rationalize that these triggers, these emotions, are the result of this overwhelming anxiety. And she has survived in the past, and she will get through that, in the future as well. So the synergistic treatment approach is always preferred in anxiety disorders. regardless of the diagnosis, PTSD, panic disorder, or generalized anxiety disorder. Studies have shown that cognitive behavior therapy is to be the most effective modality, but if you combine medications with the therapy, then they definitely work even better.
When you were talking earlier, Karen, about trying to de-link these cause and effect ideas, you know that you're a competent person, but suddenly you feel like you can't accomplish what you need to accomplish, even if it's a task like driving, which you do every day. I mean, when somebody comes into your office who's been trying to deal with this, and I can imagine for some people it comes on over a long period of time, is there a part of the process that really is just validation? This is not a personal failure on your part, because I can imagine people would feel so helpless.
Charity, I'm so glad you said that. That is absolutely true, because they feel, globally incompetent. And I think Dr. Iqbal and I would agree that anxiety disorders are highly treatable, yet only about one-third of the population that would cross a threshold for impairment from an anxiety disorder actually gets treatment.
So a lot of people are struggling with this on their own.
And feeling really incompetent and suffering, yeah.
We're talking about living with anxiety disorders this hour, treating anxiety disorders. With me, Karen Nelson, a licensed psychologist and associate clinical professor of psychiatry in the College of Medicine at the University of Iowa. Dr. Adnan Iqbal, medical director of adult psychiatric services at Mercy Medical Center in Des Moines. And we have a number of people on the line who want to be part of this conversation. You can join us as well at 866-780-9100. Ciora is on the line in North Liberty. Hello, Ciora. Ciora, can you hear me? Oh, we seem to be having some phone difficulty. So Ciora's question was about warning signs. You know, when a lot of people do deal with anxiety, when does it get to the point when you should be seeking help? Karen, do you want to try that one first?
Sure. When anxiety is and worry is part of life, when it crosses the threshold to making your world smaller in terms of not for children and adolescents, for not being able to focus in school or trying to stay away from school, or not to be able to live your life in terms of positive interactions, holding a job, going to the job, getting along with, having friends, doing things, activities that you enjoy. When it crosses that threshold, that's when you seek treatment.
Okay. And Dr. Iqbal, do you have anything you want to add to that? I know that probably, given that you both talked about how so many people live without treatment, probably a lot of people wait longer than they should.
Exactly. And I agree with Karen that psychosocial dysfunction, that's what it's called, psychosocial impairment. When it occurs, then you're diagnosed with any psychiatric disorder. But, this anxiety disorders can be subtle in a way. Not necessarily you have the mental symptom, but they can also present themselves with physical symptoms. So some of the anxiety symptoms can be headaches, muscle aches and pains, nauseated feeling, butterflies in your stomach, poor sleep. It's not necessarily per se a panic attack, but basically you are having these physical symptoms and you don't know what is causing these symptoms. So atypical presentation, and sometimes you don't recognize that you have an anxiety disorder. So it's important to get yourself evaluated, because you don't want to, your potential to be held back to something which is fairly treatable, which has a very good evidence that combination of medicines, therapy do help. So I think seeking help is the first and foremost, step to take. It could be your primary care physician. It could be, if you don't have a psychiatrist, at least get yourself evaluated. Because even in primary care settings, there are screening questions. These are PHQ questionnaire. And then once there are certain positive signs, then they can go into detail and make appropriate recommendations. primary care physicians can also prescribe, you know, these anxiety medicines. So people who live in rural area, they don't have access to these, a psychiatrist or mental health services. Make sure you discuss that with your primary care physician as well.
Are there patterns that we should know about? You work with adults with anxiety disorders. Karen, I know that you know a great deal about young people with anxiety disorders, and we'll get into that a little bit more later on. But, I mean, Dr. Iqbal, is there an age at which this tends to strike people?
Late teenage. Anxiety disorder can be in a child, but usually late teenagers to early 20s. That's when you see the most likely onset of any sort of anxiety disorder. But again, it can be any age. Unfortunately, children who are exposed to trauma, either they are physical trauma, sexual trauma, are most likely to have more earlier onset of anxiety, especially post-traumatic stress disorder. But it's fair to assume late teenage to early 20s. You would see the most likely onset.
Well, and something Kelly mentioned was that she had seen people in her family have panic attacks, so she knew what was happening to her the first time it happened to her. Is this something that tends to run in families?
Yes. It's called heritability. So you can't say it's a genetic kind of predisposition, but family members with anxiety disorders, they tend to have either their offsprings or siblings even, can have higher level of anxiety symptoms. So yes, they're in certain, because each anxiety disorder have different level of heritability, they call it. So I would assume 60, some have 60%, some have even more, like 80% in twin studies. So yes, if your family member have an anxiety disorder, you should be mindful of that. That's a possibility.
Let's go back to the phones. Dr. Lawrence Allen is on the line in Moline, Illinois. Hello, Dr. Allen. Dr. Allen, can you hear me? We may not be able to use our phone system this hour. Dr. Allen was asking about, he said that there are a lot of primary care physicians who are really unsure of what to prescribe to somebody with an anxiety disorder. Is that a problem? Is there a disconnect between primary care physicians, psychiatrists, and psychologists when it comes to dealing with anxiety? Dr. Iqbal?
Obviously, psychiatrists will have more training because they are specialized in psychiatry. Primary care physician, there is more emphasis now. There's a new model called primary care mental health integration model. Primary care physician prescribe almost 40% of the antidepressants in America. So they are a big prescriber of these medicines. So they face with it on daily basis. Some of them are more comfortable, some of them are not. Now we have more emphasis on making sure that primary care physicians, when during their training, residency training, they should spend at least 1 month in psychiatric rotation. That's what we have at Mercy. Recently, we have increased our internal medicine residents from 2 weeks to 1 month, that they should spend their time at a psychiatric rotation. So I think these are some of the steps which are very, very important for our physicians who are non-psychiatrists to be exposed to psychiatric training and medications management and other treatment. So that's one step. The other step is basically, I wish, each primary care physician have some level of collaboration with psychiatry, but obviously it's wishful to assume, especially when we have such shortage of psychiatrists in Iowa. So if your group, if your practice have some connection with the psychiatric practice, it's always a good idea to call your colleague. If that's not the case, make sure you go to American Psychiatric Association website. They have these treatment algorithms for all these disorders, anxiety, depression, very detailed. They will take you step-by-step, fashion, which medication to start. If someone doesn't respond, make sure you change the medicine. Even, there are certain states like Texas have their own treatment algorithm. So there's a lot of resources available. If you are unsure which to prescribe, just go online. APA is the best, resource. And, there are websites like Update. And then, obviously, some psychiatric you know, practice handbooks as well. They will come handy too. This is a general kind of advice. For a specifically, if they are asking me a specific group of medication, usually these are called selective serotonin or SSRIs. These are considered to be first-line medications for anxiety disorders. So virtually, they have almost universal kind of application. They are also used for depression plus anxiety disorders as well. So treatment, you know, is the same. Dosages are the same. So,
all right, we're going to take another short break. We'll be back in just a moment. We're talking about living with an anxiety disorder this hour and treating anxiety disorders. With me, Dr. Adnan Iqbal, Medical Director of Adult Psychiatric Services at Mercy Medical Center in Des Moines. Karen Nelson, a licensed psychologist and Associate Clinical Professor of Psychiatry in the College of Medicine at the University of Iowa. We're going to also talk about anxiety disorders in young people in a moment. We'll hear from a 17-year-old who is living with an anxiety disorder. This is Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. This hour, we're talking about living with an anxiety disorder and treating anxiety disorders. And with me, Dr. Adnan Iqbal, Medical Director of Adult Psychiatric Services at Mercy Medical Center in Des Moines. Karen Nelson, licensed psychologist and Associate Clinical Professor of Psychiatry in the College of Medicine at the University of Iowa. And Karen, I want to ask you a follow-up to what Dr. Iqbal was talking about just before the break, maybe a little bit of a disconnect between primary care physicians and psychiatrists when it comes to treating anxiety disorders. You mentioned how very helpful talk therapy or cognitive therapy can be for people who are dealing with anxiety disorders. Is there also a little bit of a disconnect there between maybe a physician who might want to prescribe medicine but not necessarily push someone toward cognitive therapy?
I find primary care physicians are really very, very respectful and very eager for the resources that my profession offers. Sometimes a patient is looking for a relatively quick relief because anxiety feels so terrible. So selling somebody on the benefits of psychotherapy often consists of, when you decrease this medication, will you have the strategies to cope when anxiety comes back? And that's really what, through psychoeducation and some specific techniques, psychotherapy can offer. But I think that primary care physicians in their community tend to be really well acquainted with psychotherapy resources. They would probably say that there's not enough of us.
All right, I want to get a phone call on the air before we start talking about young people with anxiety disorders. Abby is on the line in Des Moines. Hi, Abby.
Hi, how are you?
Good. What's your question?
I am a dermographic technician with a special needs four-year-old, and within my work, I have a very high stress request weight for my lists. Because of the never-ending onslaught of interested patrons, it's affecting my ability to stay in regular contact with clients that I'm already engaged with. And as well, over the last couple of years, it's been damaging and silencing all of my personal relationships, including my family. And I just wanted to know, how can one manage their anxiety in a professional setting and keep it from bleeding over into their personal lives? A lot of times, someone like me, I want everyone to know that I'm human, and there's only so much time.
Yeah, that sounds really challenging. Abby, Karen, do you want to answer that question first?
I think, like what you're saying, there's just not enough resources, and there's simply not enough of you to go around. And and people are agitated, and they may be on hold a long time to reach you or on hold to get an appointment to get contact. And something that I'm guessing that you already do is validate their frustration. But then what do you do? You know, are they advocating? You know, I bet you've advocated at the macro level to get more of you or to get more resources. But having some strategies to leave work at work is really what you're asking for. And that would start with looking at some of what your expectations of yourself within work are, and then building some rituals, like however you get to work, when you drive home, having a certain kind of music that you listen to, or certain little rituals that you do. And then when you find work popping up into your head, make a note of that, and maybe even set aside okay, I have 15 minutes at home that I'm going to worry about work, and the rest of the time I'm going to say, nope, not right now.
Abby's question leads to a question that I have, which is, you know, when you have this kind of stress on you, let's say in the workplace, and you're coping with that on a daily basis, is that something that you need to worry about escalating into the you know, realm of an anxiety disorder?
Getting skills and strategies at any point helps all of us cope better. Whether it goes to what we would define as an anxiety disorder is really is individually based. Can't really predict. But anybody can benefit from the skills and strategies, just like Abby's asking for.
We are talking about living with anxiety disorders today, and I want to turn the conversation to younger people for a moment. And we're going to hear now the voice of a young woman, a 17-year-old, who has been living with an anxiety disorder. She was diagnosed 6 years ago.
So my name is Ellie Converse. I'm from Des Moines, Iowa, and I'm 17 years old. When I was in sixth grade, I was diagnosed with obsessive compulsive disorder. And I've always been sort of a perfectionist, and I've always had anxiety issues, but that was the first time that they were ever like clinically diagnosed. And so that's mainly what I struggle with. And essentially what that means is that a lot of people think of OCD as being as just as a compulsions aspect of it. So, you know, like having to turn the doorknob 47 times, things like that. I fall more under the obsessive side of that. And so essentially what that means is that when a worry enters my head, I can't get it out. Well, when I was diagnosed, it was a little bit of a relief and a little bit of a stressor, a little bit of both. I think that it was a relief in the sense that it made me feel like there was something that I could do about it. You know, just the general idea of anxiety a lot of times and stress just is kind of hard to deal with if you don't know the specifics of it. So knowing the specifics of it was definitely helpful. But I think that it also caused a little bit more anxiety, I think, just because I, you know, especially being like 11 or 12 at the time, I didn't really know what that meant. I didn't really know what it meant for my future. It was kind of scary, the idea of having like a mental illness, something that I would have to deal with the rest of my life. But as I worked with my therapist more and more, we got it to a point where it was just kind of part of my personality as opposed to like a mental illness.
That's the voice of Ellie Converse of Des Moines, and she can't be with us live today because she's off on an international trip, which I think is a great indicator that she is dealing very well with her anxiety disorder. With us, though, is her mother, Jennifer Glover Converse of Des Moines. Hello, Jen.
Hello. I'm having a little anxiety about her being abroad.
Sure.
But that's on my end,
right.
Not hers.
You are a mother. All right. So let's go back in time. What was going on with Ellie that made you think this is bigger than just school stress or something like that?
Right. You know, one of the concerns we had, I mean, we had been watching her struggle with worries for a long time and just kind of thought it was part of her personality. But there was a time when she was adjusting to middle school, and it was her first set of tests in middle school, and she got an A, and she spent her Christmas break freaking out, really scared that it was really an F, and that she had convinced herself that actually she failed. And of course, we told her time and again, you got an A, but even if you didn't, it would be okay, and tried to do all the right things. But that was, of course, kind of the wrong thing to do, because we tried to tell her, just don't be silly, when really she wasn't being silly. She had convinced herself. And so we took her to a counselor just to sort of figure out how to work through those stresses. And in that process, relatively quickly, the counselor recognized that this was obsessive compulsive disorder. And she's been doing talk therapy ever since.
And getting that diagnosis for Ellie, the obsessive compulsive disorder, but also the anxiety,
yes.
Was that difficult for her?
It was. You know, Ellie, you heard her. I'm so proud of her. It's great to hear her voice since she's improved. But she is she didn't want to do anything wrong. And so she felt the word disorder on anxiety or obsessive compulsive was very upsetting to her. It was that word. There's nothing wrong with me. You know, I don't like something being wrong with me. But when the counselor was able to show her brain scans of people with anxiety and people without, and people with OCD and people without, and she was able to see that there's a physical difference, that made all the difference in the world for her. She was able to comprehend then that it wasn't just something she she wasn't strong enough to handle. It was something that was happening to her brain, and she needed to, and she could talk through it and address it that way. It made all the difference in the world.
What kind of treatments have been effective for her?
It's all been talk therapy with her. We're not opposed to medication if that becomes necessary, but for her right now, she's still doing well and thriving with talk therapy. You know, she's we've had to do a lot of strategies at home. You look back as a parent, and there are things that I did that if I had known this was the way her brain worked, I would have never done this. You know, I wouldn't have told her just to get over it. Or, you know, even when she was little, the stressors that seemed to really upset her, I feel like I did the exact wrong thing. I know once I said she was worried about having a B. And I said, Ellie, I want you to just not do your homework tonight and go to school tomorrow and recognize that the world will still go on, right? That mom and dad aren't worried about you, that we're not pressuring you to get an A. Just go home, just don't do your homework. Well, of course, I found out that's the exact wrong thing to tell her because that just added to her anxiety. But I think we were obviously well-intentioned, but right. It's been a training process for us as parents, too.
So as you understood what she was going through, I mean, it sounds like you had to modify a lot of your behavior.
Absolutely. We had to really think about the language that we use in the house, the way we approach her. We have to give her what we call process time. So we just have to recognize that if we're like, I see these videos online of parents surprising their kids with a Disney trip. That would never work in my world because she would not really have processed the fact that we were on vacation and having fun until Wednesday or so. So we need to give her lots of processing time. And certainly life won't always handle her processing time. But if we can give it to her in times when we can, then it allows her to be stronger for those times when she has to adjust to things on the fly.
What things are most challenging for her now that she's in high school?
Grades are very challenging for her. She does debate, and that's a very stressful activity, and so she has to manage her time very well. She also is right now really, really, really focused on the college search process. She's got a couple of spreadsheets going. She's got color-coded lists, and I know that a lot of kids do that. But for her, I think she's got this underlying anxiety that won't really rest until she knows what she's going to do. And then I know her well enough to know she will then second guess it. And so she's really working with her counselor on strategies to address this long-term solution that's stressful anyway and add in an anxiety disorder. And she's she just has to have different tools to work with it.
So when her anxiety builds and gets to the point where it may interfere with her ability to do what she needs to do, does she recognize that that's happening?
Sometimes it's interesting. Sometimes she does, sometimes she doesn't. When she was younger, we used the language of building a bridge. So she thinks of her brain in two parts, a rational side and an irrational side. That's what she calls them. And so she will talk about building the bridge between the irrational side and the rational side. And bless her heart, every now and then she'll be crying and she'll say, the bridge is broken. And, you know, it breaks my heart, but she recognizes that she can't get back there. Or, you know, she was taught to say, it's not me, it's my OCD a lot, to recognize, to separate herself from it. And sometimes she'll be like, I think I just am OCD. It just is who I am. And so there are times that she recognizes it but can't control it, which I think is the most frustrating for her.
And when she does have an issue where the bridge is broken, where things mm-hmm. are going off the rails, what treatment helps her get back to where she needs to be?
She has several sort of mantras that she'll say to herself. I don't even know them all. She needs space, so we know she needs to go to her room and kind of get away from sort of some of the stimulations around her. All the things that I as a mom want to do to help her often don't work. But for example, you know, because I want to fix it. But she was stressed about going on this overseas trip, of course, because who wouldn't be? And so for her, we just walked through her schedule, what she's going to do on this trip, and that made her feel better because she could envision it. And so we were able to get her out of that worry by giving her information. But a lot of times information doesn't help. It just requires some time and some time for her brain to get used to it.
Well, Jennifer, thank you so much for talking with us today.
Thanks for having us. Having me and her.
Jennifer Glover Confirst of Des Moines. We're talking about her daughter, Ellie Confirst, who's 17 years old and living with OCD and an anxiety disorder. And Karen, is that common where there's a co-diagnosis of perhaps two different disorders?
Absolutely. Yep. Especially co-occurring anxiety, co-occurring with depression, and sometimes a physical illness.
among young people, it feels like we're talking more about anxiety disorders than we used to. Do you feel like there's an increase in young people dealing with anxiety?
Epidemiological studies would suggest no, there's less stigma and a lot more information available online and in the culture.
All right, so maybe people are identifying it more. They understand the language or can use the language of anxiety to talk about what's going on in their lives, but not necessarily more anxiety disorders.
Correct.
And Dr. Iqbal, what are your thoughts on that? Do you feel like things are kind of holding steady?
Yes, like Karen mentioned, it's the identification, screening process, and the availability of, treatments. But, that's not the answer. Even, our first, guest, Kelly, mentioned how difficult it is to have certain medication or certain services, and the insurance to cover for that. So mental health parity is still an issue. Despite the identification and treatment availability, people are still suffering, regardless of the age group. So I do not believe we have enough resources, whether it comes to psychiatrists or mental health coverages, insurance coverages. So we're still lagging behind. So identification has improved. People are become more aware of these illnesses, and thanks in part and probably largely to the media plus, this program and people like Kelly and the other, girl who mentioned that, who shared her experiences and that had, at least normalized this experience for the rest of the people of their age group or the other age group, that the other people are there who are still struggling, and some of them do get better and there is treatment. So feeling of vulnerability and, feeling alone when you have these symptoms definitely help when someone comes forward and they lead the way. So incident probably is the same. Prevalence kind of probably, goes up and down based on how you identify them and record them. But overall, I believe, still we have, where to go.
Well, Dr. Iqbal, thank you so much for talking with us today.
Thank you very much.
Dr. Adnan Iqbal, Medical Director of Adult Psychiatric Services at Mercy Medical Center in Des Moines. And Karen, we have 30 seconds left, but do you have a word for parents who may be worried? This sounds like my child.
I think talking with your primary care physician, whether it's a pediatrician or primary care, empowering them by getting some more information, it would be my recommendation.
All right. So if you think that your child may be dealing with this, it's a great idea to ask for help.
Precisely.
All right. Karen Nelson, thank you so much for talking with us today.
My pleasure.
Karen Nelson is a licensed psychologist and associate clinical professor of psychiatry in the College of Medicine at the University of Iowa. We've been talking about living with anxiety disorders this hour and treatment for anxiety disorders. Talk of Iowa is produced at Iowa Public Radio. Our producers are Lindsay Moon, Ben Stanton, Emily Woodbury, and Catherine Perkins is our executive producer. We had technical assistance today from Helena Thompson and Rob Dillard. This is Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe.